Once more into the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode, second hour, of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and Jake McClure. Kind of takes away from the drama when you say second hour.
All right. Well, you can say anything in a monotone after and take away from the drama. Another exciting episode to some people.
Well, yeah, I suppose. Anyway, you are listening to The Personal Wealth Coach, and if you'd like to give us a telephone call, which nobody has done so far today, Saturday, May 21st, and jar our brains with a question, thought, or comment. You don't like the cats on the snare drums in the
background?
That's
not what I'm talking about. You were capping out on the... It's looking better now.
Our
volume was too high.
So you're watching me speak?
Yes.
That's really weird. Anyway, if you'd like to give us a call, there's a telephone number you could call. It's the area code is 254, in case you need an area code to put in there. And the number is 773-1400. And somebody is actually calling in on that telephone number. So if I can figure out how to work the machine, which is always questionable, then I will turn this up and say, caller, welcome to the Personal Wealth Coach. You're on the air.
Thank you. This is Eric Brown of Temple.
Hi, Eric and Brown and Temple. Wow, okay.
Anyway, whoopee.
Anyway, welcome to the program.
Hey, I'm impressed.
What I had been, I was hoping to catch you guys a few weeks ago, but apparently you were gone that weekend. So if it's not off topic, could you address what you think of, if you can define what Mr. Trump's economic policies and the impact that they would have on our lovely nation. I'd have a very low opinion, but I would prefer your educated evaluation, if there's anything that we can even nail down as definite.
We've got a lot of confusing answer to that, because early in the campaign season, he put forth a tax plan, which he's referred to on several occasions. But the tax plan that he put forth is not what he's talking about when he refers to it, because he refers to a lot of other things that aren't in the tax plan, which causes a lot of confusion. If you're going to release a tax plan and say this is what we have released and so on, then I think it probably is a good idea to refer to that plan when you say my plan, but that's not what he's referring to. But I'm going to spread the blame evenly. Sanders also released a tax plan. Hillary Clinton has not, because she's not really said she wants to change anything on the tax plan. So Sanders released a tax plan that was absolutely absurd. He's stuck to that plan. He really has said, this is the plan I'm going to use, and he's referred to that plan, and he's got everything in it that he's talking about.
Right.
It just doesn't make any sense.
It's one that says, if you make very much money at all, you can have a very short tax form. You know, the short form?
You just send it all.
How much money did you make last year? Send it in.
Right. That's not really what he put in there. What he said was he was going to increase taxes. But the amount of spending that he's going to increase is so much more than the amount of revenue expected. It's just as huge. He wants to make college free. He wants to do free health care. There's a lot of stuff he wants to do that needs to be paid for by someone.
I can summarize Donald Trump's plan. He's been very, very consistent on several points. A lot of points he's been very inconsistent and contradicting himself. But on some points he's been very, very, very clear. Number one, establish a 35% tariff on anything that comes in from China, which would bankrupt probably 20 or 30% of the S&P 500 companies. Number two, he is going to get rid of the federal debt, pay it off within 8 years. Number three, he's going to cut taxes.
Well, he's backed off on the 3 years. He's decided not to do it at all during the 8 years, because he was asked about that specifically, and he said he's decided that that may not be the top priority of the campaign.
Right, right.
That's part of the confusion here, is that when he makes a statement and says it's going to be easy, we'll pay off the debt, that's not really his policy. He's not making policy in these speeches, and the policy that he's posting in written form gets changed a lot.
Well, he also said he's not going to touch Social Security or Medicare. So they stay in place as they are. But he is going to increase defense spending substantially, and he's going to increase spending on border security by a bunch of billions of dollars. So what he wants to do, then he wants to cut taxes. So he's going to reduce taxes, dramatically increase spending, and as a third priority, not his highest priority, pay off the national debt in a relatively short period of time.
He on his tax plan, for instance, says that there will be, if you make, this is what it says on his website, if you're single and earn less than $25,000 or married and jointly earn less than $50,000, you don't pay any income taxes. Everybody else...
That's kind of the way it is now.
Yeah, it is, and that's part of the point here, is that that's not a change at all. That's 50%, more than 50% of American households don't pay income taxes. Now, at the congressional level, we spend their tax money in Social Security and Medicare and so on anyway. So that exists. But we're just talking about income taxes, not the taxes that are spent in the general funds that aren't income taxes. So everybody else gets four tax brackets, 0, 10, 20, and 25%. And he's going to get rid of the alternative minimum tax. He doesn't say where the revenue comes from for the other projects, because basically those numbers don't provide the revenue needed to do any of the projects that he's talking about doing, much less conquering the debt.
The other thing he's going to run into, were he to try to implement this plan, is this bill that is law that would have to be repealed for him to do this. It's called the Balanced Budget Act.
Right.
Passed Newt Gingrich, Bill Clinton signed it. Newt Gingrich pushed it through Congress, Bill Clinton signed it. And basically says if you're going to cut taxes, you have to cut spending by the same amount, and the Congressional Budget Office has to certify that you've cut the spending in order to cut the taxes.
Which is part of the reason why the war spending was off the books, right. Emergency spending, that sort of thing, because they couldn't...
Right. So if he's going to cut the 39.4, I think it is, tax bracket, which is the highest bracket right now for people who earn a relatively large amount of money, above $250,000 a year for a couple adjusted gross income, then... if he's going to cut that to 25%, and he's going to cut the 28% to 25%, he's going to cut, I mean, you start down the list of the, there's a lot of people in the upper income brackets who would pay, under Trump, would pay a lot less in taxes. The problem is, in order to make that legal and even not violate the law, he would have to cut government spending hugely. And frankly, there's only three areas in which government spending could be cut enough to accommodate his tax proposal, and that's Social Security, which he said he won't touch, Medicare, which he said he won't touch, and defense spending.
Which he said he won't touch.
Well, he's going to raise it.
Right. So this is where it gets confusing, and it gets confusing on all of the candidates now, because right now we haven't hit the stage in the election cycle where they're talking about reality. Usually that happens fairly early in the election cycle when they've knocked out the other people that are running in the primaries, and then they start talking about actual policies. Now they're still talking about cotton candy and free stuff for everybody.
I'm going to have to disagree with you. We have a reality TV show star.
Oh, yes. It should be reality.
So he is talking about...
There is one point in his tax plan that makes sense. Anybody that's listened to us for very long has heard us talk about the Laffer point on the revenue curve. If you raise taxes above the Laffer point, you lower revenue to the government because people stop working because the taxes got too high. If you lower taxes too far below the Laffer point, you lower revenue to the government. So there's a sweet spot, and the sweet spot moves around every year with the economic conditions. If money is easy to get, there are easy loans. You can raise that amount, and you can get more revenue. And so that point moves up and down. And the only place that we are clearly above the Laffer point as far as tax revenue goes is in business taxes. The top tax rate in business is well above the Laffer point. We have the highest corporate tax rates in the world. And he is saying to lower that down to 15. That may actually raise revenue. The rest of the stuff he's talking about doesn't make a lot of sense. So,
right. So
neither does anybody else.
On that point, it's unreality.
Right.
It's just his own version of unreality.
Well, everything else he's saying is too. For instance, if you look at the cost, if the wall becomes a reality, which is one of his centerpieces.
Well, the wall gets paid for by Mexico.
Well, the problem is that
Mexico doesn't want to pay for it.
There's some indication in Mexico that they have no desire to pay for a wall between Mexico and the United States.
But he's a negotiator. He'll negotiate something with them.
Well, the difficulty,
that's
presuming that he actually built the wall from somewhere, we'd have to get a lot of billions of dollars.
Yes, depending on the size of the wall, and that has been a changing subject as well. He started out with a 40-foot wall. At some point, he said 80-foot wall. There isn't a plan here. So, it's really hard for us to take it seriously. Any of the candidates right now are hard to take seriously on their policies because they're not really giving concrete policies. That makes us very much in the dark.
Well, I don't know. Bernie Sanders has had some very concrete policies.
He's very concrete, but yes.
Free health care.
Free college.
And free higher education for everybody.
Yes.
The one thing I appreciate about Sanders is that he's consistent. And he's honest about what he believes and what he wants to do.
Honestly a socialist.
So,
very honestly a socialist.
I hate to break this to you, but so was Hitler.
Well, that's true.
Yeah, he was pretty consistent.
Absolutely,
he didn't change his mind about stuff.
And
no,
Bernie Sanders is very consistently insane. But he's very pleasantly insane. He's like the granduncle or grandfather, something that you keep in the closet most of the time.
You asked a question. I'm going to answer the question that I think you meant to ask. What are the results of any of the candidates actually getting elected? And my answer to that, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say that basically I'm not positive about any of them getting elected if they're able to pass any of their policies.
That's the key point. At this point, Congress is not held in high esteem. I don't hold them in high esteem. The people of the United States don't hold them in high esteem, except their own representative who they keep reelecting.
So
Congress has to pass the tax laws. Congress has to change the spending laws. When the presidents are basing their entire platform on things that are beyond their power, they are in the hands of Congress. What I can tell you without a whole lot of qualms is that if this is a close election, Congress is not going to pass their spending bills. Congress is not going to change the tax code. Congress is not going to authorize an 80-foot wall that nobody's paying for. So
Agreed. The
end result of any of the three candidates is pretty much status quo, because the Congress is looking at the things that are being said by all the candidates, including Hillary Clinton, and saying, well, yeah, we're not going to do that. When the Speaker of the House says, yeah, Donald Trump is the Republican candidate and I don't endorse him, the Speaker is the one who controls what comes to the floor. He can say, we're not even going to vote on that bill. It doesn't matter what committee it went through. He can say, nope, not coming to the floor, sorry. So status quo is what we're looking at, and it's generally what we look at. This is why we have checks and balances. This is the very first internet election in the United States. It is almost purely Democratic. And this is the problem with democracy. It's why we have a republic. It's why we elect representatives to study things, because our emotions about a subject can change in a heartbeat.
Let me interject something in here. A wise man said recently, named Warren Buffett. He said, and this was with his assumption, whether Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton,
because nobody really
elected,
thinks Sanders is going to get elected
president, Berkshire Hathaway in the United States of America will do just fine. And I honestly believe that's true. Now, do I think having a guy in the White House who shoots his mouth off and says that that was a terrorist attack and we should retaliate against somebody in nonspecific, or who says things like, the thing is, with terrorists, what you need to do is take out their families, which he has not recanted on, by the
right.
way.
That's just...
Which is war crimes. Having somebody like that in the White House making statements to that effect, I think would be embarrassing.
I think...
Destabilizing and a little crazy, but...
I've been embarrassed about the things that Joe Biden says. He about once a month opens his mouth, which he's not supposed to do. That's off limits. No, Joe Biden, keep your mouth closed. But every once in a while, he opens his mouth and he says something really stupid. And if you list all the things that are just part of the normal dialogue in this presidential election, I mean, when the primaries are focusing on the size of the digits on a hand, you know, the small fingers, this is pure silliness. Now, we're not talking policy. We're not talking economics. We're not talking reality. We're talking about popularity. We're talking about demagoguery. We have two very populist candidates that are just running on anger against the establishment. And we have one establishment person, which even people in the establishment aren't happy with the establishment. So we have this confusing mess of politics that's going on right now, and it's causing confidence issues across the country. When we consider that our monetary system and our economic system is based on the confidence that we have in it, this is not a healthy political debate. This is an unhealthy political debate that we're having right now.
Let me make a comment about economics that whoever is elected president is going to need to deal with. And they're going to need to perform some kind of leadership because they're going to be forced to do so. And Congress is going to have to do something about it. Now, the question is what? There's an article in the Wall Street Journal, in Financial Times today about the comparison of health care in the United States and the United Kingdom. One of the very telling numbers that pops up in there is a family of four in the United States on average is spending $25,000 a year out of pocket.
That's
on healthcare.
Insurance costs and deductibles and copays and everything else.
That's not counting what their employer pays. That's right. Counting what they either comes out of their pay or they have to literally pay to some form of healthcare provision. Now let's back up a step. The median income in the United States for a worker is $53,000. So if we have this traditional family where you have a father who is working and a mother who is, and I realize it's not necessarily the model, but still.
A mother at home.
The mother at home.
They're spending half of their income.
They're spending, and if both of them are making $53,000, which is probably a more typical situation, they're spending, not counting taxes, which we are going to take, even if you're in the, if it was $103,000. $106,000 now, okay, for this couple is their gross income.
Right.
They're going to be paying probably $20,000, $25,000 in taxes.
More than that, maybe. If they live in California or if they live in Connecticut, they're paying more than that.
Okay, so and then they're going to be paying another $25,000 for health care costs. In other words, between health care and the government, half of their income disappears, and that is... The health care costs in the United States have risen so fast, and
the only comparison is college costs. And both cases, when the government says we will pay without negotiation, whether it's Medicare that says that they have to pay a non-negotiated medical cost, whether it's medicine or whatever, or federal student loans that they're just going to give the loan to the student no matter what the degree plan at the rate that the college is charging.
I'm going to disagree with you. Medicare argues with hospitals and doctors all the time. They negotiate.
True, but
they
not cannot, for medicine.
In the biggest growth number in medical costs is mandated by law. Congress, under George W. Bush, when the Republicans controlled it, and I'm going to lay it right at their lap because they bear full responsibility for this, passed a bill.
We said it on the air at the time.
Prescription drug care bill for people on Medicare, they specifically forbade Medicare from negotiating a cost with the medicine providers, the medical, and as a result, whatever, which is, by the way, why Valiant and all these other companies took something that cost $3.59
and turned it into $750
a pill, because Medicare is forbidden by law from arguing with that price. And as a result, the price of medicine has doubled in the last 5 years and is still accelerating. Somebody is going to have to deal with that.
You've heard us talk about college costs acceleration. And this, again, comes back to, it's not free college, but when the government will give you a subsidized loan at low interest and they're not going to help you negotiate with the college to get the best rate, then the price is not what you can afford anymore. It's what you can afford over your lifetime. It's what you can afford with government assistance. And that means that the colleges, and if you look at the colleges, this is, you know, I have a firm belief that college education is extremely important. But when you look at the fact that administration employees have doubled in number over the last 7 years.
Yes.
We're not talking about professors.
I didn't realize it was that short.
Yes.
Time
span. So that is a, there are these key issues where the government says, we're going to let the free market take care of this. We're not going to negotiate at all. And I kind of say, wait a minute, do you not know what the free market is? Because free market is negotiation. If the government comes in with a big money bag and says, here you go, then anybody that's trying to negotiate on their own doesn't get to.
No, the free market is the lobbyists who go to Congress.
Oh, right, from the drug manufacturers.
From the drug manufacturers and the universities and the universities' systems,
right.
And the people they pay that says, you will, you know, you pass a law that says the government will just pay us whatever we ask and with no questions asked.
There's a fascinating piece there in administration growth in Congress. A large portion of that growth has been for lobbying. People involved in either getting grants from the government, writing grants, or in actual efforts to create grants that didn't exist before. So you've got that concept, and we know about this. I mean, in the local school districts, you have people whose job, their entire job, and they make decent livings, is to write grants.
Grant writing.
And it's quite often when you look at the books, and we do this, we look at books for school districts just for the fun of it, and you look at the cost that goes into the employees that are writing the grants and the amount of grants that they get, and it's slightly profitable for the school district. But most of those grants are taken up by the pay of the grant writer.
Now, wait a minute. You have to understand, this is an ancient tradition in the United States. You took us back to the 19th century.
Let's go back. Yes.
These grants are all in the United States, right?
Right.
So they're U.S. grants.
Yes.
And that was the name of probably the drunkest, most corrupt president in the history of the United States was U.S. Grant.
But he was a pretty good general.
Well, he was, really. Basically, he got drunk and said, attack.
Charge!
and since we had a lot of people and better weapons than the other guys did, it worked. Very consistently.
And just keep charging.
Yes.
You got better weapons. Go get them.
Which is the origin probably of the idea of using a charge card.
Could be.
Yeah, anyway.
I think we may be stretching metaphors into reality there.
Well, I don't know. You never can tell. You know, it's charging is charging, whichever way you look at it. And it's expensive, as he learned. But he didn't pay a lot of attention to that.
Eric, we took a simple question and turned it into somehow we got into drunken presidents from the late to mid 1800s.
By the way, but U.S. Grant is an example of why, if Donald Trump is elected, the United States will survive.
Right. We have a history of surviving bad presidents.
I mean, we survived Jimmy Carter.
We survived Obama.
We survived, well, Obama.
We're not quite there yet, but I think we're going to make it.
Fascinatingly, I strongly suspect that history will record Obama not as a great president, but as a good president.
It's a decent president. I don't even know that they will go so far as a good president. He's not a great leader. Foreign policy was kind of falling apart during his watch. He got some of his trademark stuff done, and the things that he really wanted, he got that done.
Sure.
If you look back at Carter, he didn't get anything done. If you George H.W. Bush, I loved that guy. He really didn't get a whole lot done.
Right. But the point I wanted to make in this.
Well, thanks, guys. I always enjoy whichever direction you end up going.
And I thank you for your occasional messages and and things to us, Eric, that enlighten us as to
good
to
fodder.
Keep foddering.
Okay.
You are a good fodder. You are a good fodder. Bye bye. And this is the Personal Wealth Coach. Telephone numbers in here 773-1400. Of course, the area code is 254. And because we are capitalist tools, we must play commercials on behalf of Town Square Media, KTEM, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. And as Arnold Schwarzenegger so famously said in The Terminator?
Well, his name is Schwarzenegger.
Arnold Schwarzenegger so famously said in The Terminator, I'm back.
I'll be back.
I'll be back. Well,
we are back. So you messed up his name and the quote, so that's fine.
We could change it. We be back. We are back.
We are back.
And it is the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And the telephone number in here is 254-773-1400.
Yes, I had something that I wanted to talk about, the behavior aspect of why things are the way they are and how silly we are as people. Uber, which is the driving company that goes out and takes people from point A to point B or point C and so on, not the reference to the German class of people. Uber has been releasing some pricing data to the world, which is great if you're an economist and probably pretty boring if you're not. But we're economists, so we find it really, really exciting. One of the things that they released was how often people use Uber when they look at the fare, how much they pay to go from point A to point B, C, whatever, when it's above its normal amount. They call it surge pricing. If there's a lot of traffic going on, a lot of people are calling up. If there aren't that many Uber drivers in the area, they do surge pricing. And what they've found is, at the beginning, not all that surprising. If it's a big surge, there's a lot of people needing rides, not a lot of drivers available, they start increasing the prices. And what they found is that if you double the price, people are a lot less likely to use Uber than if you only increase it by 1.9 times. So not quite double. It's pretty close to double, but not quite double. And people go, well, of course, that's cheaper. You're going to go, more people are going to take that 1.9 times the price instead of the 2 times the price. But then the confusing number comes out. More people will use the price if it's 2.1 times the fare than 2 times the fare. So it's slightly more than double, but it's not a round number. So say the fare was going to be $10, and they say your price is now $20. People are a lot less likely to use it than if you say your price will be $20.50. Because we're weird. We as humans, when we see an arbitrary number that's twice the amount on there, we say, you're just making that up. That's just a made-up number. But when somebody actually does just make up a number and says 2.1, there's nothing to support that, but it looks slightly random, people go, oh, well, there must be some kind of statistic behind that that causes the surge pricing to go into it. They don't really think about it, but they say this is 20.5. Well, there must be a reason why it's $20.50, so I'm going
to
do it.
We kind of tend to think that markets drive things, and surge pricing could be driven by the market. In other words, supply and demand. We're used to the laws of supply and demand, and we actually like them.
Right, and it's kind of a fantasy world because that's not really what drives prices.
But
it's a big part of what drives prices.
But the point is, if somebody just arbitrarily doubles the price, well, that's not proper supply and demand.
Right.
That's just arbitrary, so somebody obviously is rigging the prices.
Except that in those surge times, and this is what Uber has kind of let out, they haven't done it officially, but they avoid the double number. They skip it. They go from 1.9 times the price to 2.1 times the price.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
And they're doing it based on the number of drivers available. They're doing it based on supply and demand. But when supply and demand gives a number that looks like it's just a round number that's arbitrarily thrown in there, people don't like it.
And that actually makes sense because of the conspiracy theory.
Any conspiracy theory. Yes, you can throw in any conspiracy theory. They're just doing that to make me pay more.
There's just one big conspiracy theory that the big, rich, smart guys are putting it over on us, and they are...
Right.
They probably are, but that's beside the point.
Well, if they're big and rich, then they've made a profit.
Yeah.
And almost by definition, that's not fair.
Right.
That's where the word fair comes in, and it's silliness. Bernie Sanders' definition of fair is that everybody needs to get an equal amount. My definition of fair is that it's a marketplace in old Europe that people went and bought and sold things. Generally, if they wanted to stay in business, they needed to do it at a profit. And if you were buying from someone and you wanted to keep buying from them, then they couldn't charge too much or you'd go to somebody else.
Unless the king arbitrarily set the price.
If the king arbitrarily set the price, and that did happen sometimes, that's market fixing. And in reality,
it's the opposite
fair.
Of breaking.
When we say market fixing, the word market and the word fair are the same word. So it was fair fixing.
Right. Well, actually, it's royal fixing.
Royal fair fixing.
And we got a really royal fixing job.
Right. So, and that's one of my great pieces of humor, in my opinion, is that the word fair just means market. And when people come to me and say, is the market fair? I can, yeah. That's the definition. Fair is market. And when there was a licensed scale, that scale was licensed and you would only use this. It was going to be at the fair. So the fair scale was the licensed scale that had all the weights measured properly. That's just
it was used
piece
at
of
the
humor.
Fair. Yes. There's something in a slightly different subject. By the way, again, the telephone number is 773-1400 here. I may be coughing while I'm talking, so... please bear with me on this. But
it's part of the reason why we haven't been on the air for a while.
It's because a lot of air was coming out of
yes,
my lungs.
Yes, coming out rather forcefully.
Yes. There's a couple of things going on in the United States that are pretty important. And fundamentally, they are why Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump are so popular.
Yes.
It was an analysis done it's published in the Financial Times, about what is going on in incomes around the world. It's not just in the United States, too. It's happening throughout the developed world, and to even more concentrated percentage of this is happening in the non-developed world. And what happens is something that's typical during periods of rapid socioeconomic change, rapid technological change. The people who are able to adapt to the changes, who have the education, the intelligence, and the drive to learn new, and it's a technical term, stuff, tend to make a lot of money in periods of change. The people who are very proficient at and very happy at something that is from the older technological set, or they're not particularly well-educated or particularly high intelligence, have a tendency to suffer during those periods. And that's what's going on. About 20% of America since 2000 has actually seen, 20% of the workers in the United States have actually seen wages decrease in a very real sense. They're working just as many hours, they're getting paid less. Another 10 to 20% have not had their increases in wages keep up with inflation, or cost of living more specifically, during that same period of time. So you have in the United States today about 40% of the population who, to use the vernacular term, feels like they've been screwed. And they're angry. And they're angry because they signed on to, and they generally, by the way, tend to be white and male and middle age or older. Now, that doesn't mean there's also a set of younger people who feel like they've been cheated, which is the Bernie Sanders supporters. And what happened is, again, they bought into the old paradigm. If you get a college education, for example, it doesn't make any difference what you get it in. And you spend a lot of money on your college education, you owe a lot of money, you'll get a job, and you'll have a very high income going forward. That's just not true anymore. What's true is if you get a degree, particularly in a technical field that causes you to have the word engineer somewhere in your job title, your income has been going up very, very quickly. If you have a degree in, quote, communications or something like that, some vague, touchy, for lack of better terms, touchy-feely degree that doesn't mean a whole lot except for the fact you spent 4 years and a lot of money and got a degree, then you're in a world of hurt. And I can really understand that. So fundamentally, unless a person is competent in math, physics, and the ability to communicate effectively in the English language, particularly in written format, and has specific skills relating to technology, odds are they're not doing too well. That's about 40% of the population right now. And that 40% of the population is indeed angry and participating in the elections, and they infect with their anger people around them. So you really wind up with about half of the potential electorate being unhappy and angry with a system that they bought into because they were told by older people this is the way you do it, and it has not worked. It has not paid off, and they're mad at the system that put them in that position.
I've done some ongoing research. I've been doing this since the early 2000s. I've been every year as the IRS releases data on incomes.
Mm-hmm.
I've been adding that data to my analysis. I've been looking at the number of returns, number of people that are filing returns, whether they're filed jointly, how the incomes are coming in, and I've refuted some of the larger economists out there when they say things like Robert Reich says that the income inequality is so bad. The biggest piece of refute that I have, there's this thought that the income disparity is really big. You know, Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders both talk about it. And it's true. People that make a lot of money tend to make more money than people that don't make a lot of money. It's pretty amazing.
Note that he said that. That's Nobel Prize.
Right. Nobel Prize winning stuff. And when people use different vocabulary to say exactly what I just said, it sounds unfair. The reality is that people that make a lot of money do make more money than people that don't. But the largest growing section of in income groups, section of our economy, it is the second largest group when we break down the earnings. I start with a group that says, you've got no adjusted gross income. And that group is a really small group. It's a small group every year. They really are not that, I mean, we're talking less than 2% of the people. No adjusted gross income. As of the last date that the IRS has actually given us data, the beginning of 2014 area, 1.43% of the people that file taxes don't have any income. No adjusted gross income. Okay.
Well, wait a minute. You got to take into account there's a lot of people who don't file taxes who don't have income, too.
Which is why I look at census data next. And I say, what is the population of the United States? How many of them are above the age? So the same kind of concept that the Labor Department says, these are people that are working. Okay. So the largest group of people, and the next group is $1,000 to $5,000 as far as earnings. And then all the way, and then $5,000 to $10,000, $10,000 to $15,000, $15,000 to $20,000. I do it in $5,000 increments until it gets a little silly to do that. And then I do it in $10,000 increments. And then at some point I go to $25,000. And then I start going up into millions. So the largest group of people, largest increase in group of people, if we look back to when I started collecting the data back in the early 2003, about 6.5% of the people that filed taxes were making more than $100,000, $100,000 to $200,000. So this is in 2003. We haven't had huge inflation since then. We haven't had our standard of living increase or decrease drastically. So these numbers are pretty consistent. So about 6.5% of the filers made $100,000 or between $100,000 and $200,000. Well, as of 2014, 12% of the people, it's nearly doubled, make between $100,000 and $200,000.
Right. I agree with you.
The number of people that make between $50,000 and $75,000 is less. There are less people making that amount of money.
But remember, the median is $53,000.
If you go back through this, yeah, and that median has risen. That's mm-hmm. a key point.
Right.
If you go back through, the lower income groups have shrunk in size. There are fewer of them. The people that are making more money, there are more of them. So keep that in mind when people say the income disparity, when they say the really super fabulously wealthy are making a lot more than the people that just a few years ago were the normal Americans.
I don't question that for a second. I do say, though, that there is a significant portion of the population, which if you take all the factors and combine them, you have to make a scientific wild guess here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's around 40% whose real income over the last three decades
has been about the same.
Has either been about the same or the lower portion of the drop. Now, listen to my point.
I've got to address that. Go ahead and hit your point, and then I'll address that.
They have watched the rest of the economy move, the rest of the people working move up. Or at least the perception is they have moved up.
That's the perception.
And this group of people has been left behind.
Okay, let me address it. I'm going to address it. 40% of the people have been in that group. Yes, but it's not the same 40% it's a different group
that.
Of people. The perception is that the people in this group stay in this group their whole life. They never make more money than this. And that's not reality. I mean, even if you're talking about a bus driver, at the beginning of their life, they make a lot less than at the end of their life.
And I don't question that. I'm saying that there are people out there, though, a lot of people, let me give you an example from Fred. You know Fred?
You're going to have to be
Federal Reserve something. Or other. It's a database maintained by the Federal Reserve. It's called Fred. If you go back to the 1980s and you look at the number of people working in manufacturing,
mm-hmm.
the index is 140. Okay.
Okay. That's the numbers. We're going to give it a number of 140. That's
right.
How many people are there.
It's currently 90.
Uh-huh. There's a lot fewer people doing it.
A lot of those people lost their jobs and moved to a lower income job. But the other side of it is a lot of the people in manufacturing, for instance, just using a more specific number. When General Motors declared bankruptcy, it had a certain number of employees. It now has a third fewer. That third of employees that used to work for General Motors are doing something else now, but they're probably not making as much money. And by the way, if you look where Bernie Sanders is doing really, really well in the voting, it's generally across what is known as the Rust Belt.
Yeah. That's the same areas that Donald Trump is doing well. The coal miners that are being laid off,
mm-hmm.
and that's not the Rust Belt. That's a different Rust Belt. We're talking the same stuff, though.
But that's the point I wanted to make. The reason that Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump are doing well is there is a sector of the population that is very angry, who feel like, despite the fact they are not going hungry, they're probably living better than they did 30 years ago. But they have seen the rest of the economy move on, and in many cases, using the example of the union worker for General Motors, who was, and this is purely hypothetical, it is, I think, realistic. The guy who was bolting fenders onto vehicles on the Chevrolet assembly line, and the reason I remember that is because many years ago, more years than I like to think, I had a stepbrother who worked for General Motors as a manager, in the General Motors assembly plant in Arlington, Texas. And he took me, when I was in high school, on a tour of the General Motors assembly plant in Arlington, Texas, and I actually saw the assembly line where they were assembling all these new cars coming down. And I remember one particular guy. There were a series of, I think, eight nuts that had to be tightened to hold the fender, the left front fender, onto this new car that was coming down the assembly line. And there was a fender sitting in a thing there. He would pick it up, slide it over the bolts that were sticking out of the main body of the car. You with me?
Mm-hmm.
He had a gun. He would pop a nut on there, and he would go zrunk, 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 eight times as the thing is moving down the assembly line.
Right.
He would turn and walk back up the assembly line, pick up another fender.
Yeah, and that job doesn't exist anymore.
The point is that he was getting paid, and I don't remember the exact numbers at the time, but I remember thinking, if I could make that much money a year, because my stepbrother told me how much he was getting paid. And I was thinking, man, if I could make that much money a year, I would be so rich, I would be unable to figure out what to do with all the money. And that guy is probably flipping burgers. I mean, if presuming the guy is still there, the hypothetical person is probably flipping burgers at McDonald's now, because a robot now does that job. That's the group of people who are angry and who are driving the political train right now. A, I just wanted to comment, that's normal in an industrial revolution.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me...
And B, it's real.
Right. So the last really good numbers that the IRS has released were for 2013. If we go back to 2005... people that made $40,000 or less in their adjusted gross income in their tax return wound up being 60% of the population. So that's the vast majority. That's 60. If all of them were voting, they would elect whoever they wanted. So 60% of the population made less than $40,000. Same time period, or same group in 2013, 55% of the people make less than $40,000. So during that time, 8 years has passed. And during that 8 years, 5% of the of the filing population moved out of that group and into another. And we've got new people coming in and people dying. And that's one of the problems with these numbers. When you look at 40% doing this or 50% doing that, is it's not the same group of people every year. We're getting close to the end of the hour. But even when we're talking about people that are making $10 million or more on their tax return, that's usually from the sale of a business. Or it could be a hedge fund manager, but they're not having income taxes in the same group. So when you look at that group, that is 0.01% of the population.
Right.
And when we have a recession, that group falls down to a much, much tinier figure. And when we have big growth, it gives it to a bigger figure. More people make more money in good economies, and more people make less money in bad economies. And one of the problems with this is that in the media, a lot of times they compare numbers from 2007 against numbers from 2013, and they say the rich people are doing great and the poor people are doing poorly.
All I'm trying to say is the rich people, as the economy has recovered, particularly since 2009, the better off people and the upper middle class has done a lot better.
Right.
But the people in the bottom, roughly 40%, agreed, have not seen any improvement in their lives. They haven't.
I tend to think that it's a different group in the bottom 40%.
I'm telling
it was.
You that they are not, they're just there, okay?
I know that's
during
what
that
you're
time
telling.
Period. Okay.
I recognize
and we're out of time. You are listening to the Person and Wealth Coach, and during the week, we have real-life people to answer the phone. During the weekend, if you want to call, you can leave a voicemail. The area code, of course, is 254, and our local number is 947-1111.
You can also reach that number toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can see our ugly mugs and our beautiful staff. You can listen to our podcasts. You can read our newsletters. You can also contact us through the webpage or directly in email, jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. We really enjoy reading those emails, and it provides us great subject matter for later. So until next week, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.
Truth. It's not just a word on your Fox News station. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.